Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
Oh, good morning, everybody. Kristen is on assignment, as they say. She's actually had a speaking engagement in Madison last night. I think she has another one tonight as well. She'll be back in studio tomorrow as we wind it up with Bill and Joe, as we wind up the week in politics, as we often do, or always do, I should say, with the Political Power Hour, first of 2 hours every day on Point Taken. A word about the weather. I mean, I'm always fascinated by the response in the text line about weather reports. Getting mad about the weather is never a good idea. I don't really understand the anger there. But I would always trust someone who's educated, trained, experienced in weather data and the analytics of what that job is before I would ever trust the texter on weather reporting. But just, I think the point is, for all of us who are in news, and I'm not a journalist by any stretch of the imagination, but all of us who report the news and talk about the news, and on days like today, talk about the weather, you should be aware that there's a potential for severe storms. And then I think that's just the smart thing to be aware of, and that sometimes you have to take precautions, especially with, if our tornadic weather becomes part of that story, or hail can be very damaging as well, as I learned last year with that hailstorm in May. So just a word of the wise, pay attention to the radio, pay attention to the 620 WTMJ, because we will keep you up to date on the latest on the storms. I hope it goes north, but as we've learned previously, sometimes when you think you're not going to get it, you get it, and vice versa. So please pay attention to the weather reports that we will have for you throughout the day on WTMJ. A busy show today. 11 o'clock hour. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on the tees here, but 11 o'clock hour, Jeremy Janine from Urban Milwaukee will join us. Always great at sort of recapping the local stories, local politics, development. Even I think we have some 794 stuff in there today. So he'll be here in the 11 o'clock hour. At 10:35, Leo Krenz from Krenz Hannon International, import-export company, will join us, sort of giving us a real-life perspective, real-life, real-time, on what actually is going on at the ports, with trade, imports, exports, what's the real impact from someone who actually works there? I mean, there's so many people speculating on this stuff. And even the tariff question, and this is sort of where I want to lead this half hour, because Chris and I talked a little bit about this the other day, maybe it was 2 days ago, about the perception that I have that maybe Donald Trump, president of the United States, isn't getting enough credit for actually accomplishing some things. Now, a lot of this is often viewed from the lens of perception versus reality. But if the public perceives something, that goodwill, that good news can certainly propel a president to higher favorability ratings and higher performance when it comes time for midterm elections and the like. I'm not saying that's going to happen yet because we're still way away from that. But when you see for the first time in 5 years, prices are lower, consumer prices dropping significantly, even with the tariff uncertainty, which we'll talk about at 10:35. Even in that area, there's some bad news. Walmart says they'll raise prices based on tariffs. I've heard that from some other manufacturers and businesses as well. So I think there's a way to look at this question without the prism of your party affiliation and just say, okay, so what's going on? What are the things we talked about in the run-up to this election in November, presidential election? Well, we certainly had all the drama on the Democratic side with the departure of President Biden, replacements by Vice President Kamala Harris. We know how that turned out. And I've said for the record many times that was a ill-fated process that was probably doomed for failure when they made that decision. But set that aside. President Donald J. Trump won the election fairly and squarely. Just because I want to be on the record, just like Joe Biden won the election fairly and squarely 4 years prior. But do we look at politics? It's the question. It's this age-old question. Is all politics personal? Do you have to hate the president if he's not in your party? Do you have to love this president if they are in your party? And I would say the answer for me is no. You look at the pieces of the story. What are we talking about? Today, the Supreme Court hearing arguments on birthright citizenship. I've been pretty clear on where I stand on that. Guaranteed rights. You're born here, you're a citizen. End of story. My opinion. So I think when you look at the tenure of Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, second term, easy to say, lots of uncertainty. Easy to say, tremendous number of executive orders and actions, unlike anything we've ever seen in recent history, on all kinds of issues. Some are so far out of the norm that I don't think they'll ever survive a legal test. Certainly any opportunity by Congress to put the stamp of approval on whatever those executive actions or orders are. But the tariff one is interesting to me. Because as I look today, 401ks are rebounding. Markets looking better. S&P now above where it was at the beginning of the year. Those are standards and measures and real numbers that should matter to you when you look and assess a president. I'm under no illusion that someone who does not like Donald Trump is all of a sudden going to like Donald Trump. For a lot of people, that's a bridge too far, a line they will not cross. And, you know, I look at the impact on our budgets. And if your 401k, and Texas said their 401k is tanking, well, then you might have to want to look at your investments. S&P's up for the year. Markets have really rebounded in the last few weeks since the now famous Liberation Day, which saw a massive decline. These are things you have to look at with a more critical eye than just your party affiliation. So many talking heads, TV, radio, they spend all their time making a political point and not actually just looking at the facts of the case. You can't complain about the markets and not talk about the fact that they've rebounded for the most part. You can't just throw tariffs out there as a bad thing and not say, okay, are we going to get to a deal with China? Perhaps. We don't have a deal yet. We have frameworks for deals, which is sort of a concept that Donald Trump likes to throw out on occasion. If that's real, we're going to find out. Because if these tariff concepts or deals are not real, I know that one group that will suffer, and that's the American consumer. They will pay the price, literally, for the increased cost of goods passed on by the companies who are having to pay these higher prices for materials, resources, products that they then sell to you. Lots to talk about on this Thursday. 855-616-1624. Your thoughts and texts. Take a quick break here. Listening, of course, to 620 WTMJ. Thanks for tuning in on this Thursday. Kristen Bryant will be back tomorrow as we celebrate the week in politics with Joseph Pecky and Bill McCaution. I love the text line. I'm going to give you a sample. I always get a lot of text, so I'm going to give you a sample. There are no tariffs on things made here, harvested here. I get your points. I'm a big fan of made in the USA. Try to always buy things made in the USA. That's not a perfect science, though. Some things aren't made here. And some of our food imports that we really like aren't produced here, are grown here as well. The issue of Trump's is an interesting one. That's why I want to spend this segment talking about that. I'm not asking you to like him. I didn't vote for him. I think he can be dangerous on many fronts. I think he's ill-informed, including on tariffs, or at least out of date on what he thinks about tariffs. Texas says, I cannot stand the man as a person. I'm not asking to like him. Here's the deal, though. He's the president of the United States. And as popular as those bumper stickers I saw on yesterday or the day before, not my president. And those are not unique to Donald Trump. We saw it under Joe Biden as well. It's a reality that Donald Trump will be our president until the next presidential election. in 2028. Actually, just after that, in January of 29. And I get, and I've probably got 10 texts that say this on the Siding Unlimited WTMJ talking text line. The market just regained what it lost. Well, actually, the S&P's up. I want you to think without that lens of politics. I know it's hard to do because so much of talk radio, that's what it is, right? It's noise produced by people who have never had real jobs outside of broadcasting, talking about many things on a superficial level. And I get it works. People make a lot of money doing that. Yeah, that's cool. I prefer to have a more knowledge-based, fact-based, analytics-based analysis. It doesn't mean that I'm going to sit here and read stats to you. I read those stats, but that's boring, and we're not doing that. I'm giving you a high-level analysis that says the market has rebounded. My friend Dave Spano at Annex Wealth Management pretty much nailed it. There's some uncertainty over tariffs. In the long run, that shakes out. People see opportunity. When the market drops a bit, good bargains for solid companies to invest in. Always starts with a plan, as he'll remind you. But unless we get to a point, and this is the big picture piece, unless we get to a point where people are willing to take the personality out. I know we're completely pegged on the old personality meter to the other side of the equation. It's all personality now, Donald Trump being a glaring example of that. I get it. But until we get to a point where that's not the motivation, for one, for people to get into politics, for two, for people to decide who they vote for because the person's fun or interesting or whatever, but actually knows what they're doing, we're not going to get out of this mess. I don't care what party you're looking to support. Texter says, this has nothing to do with my party affiliation. I was a Republican. We as humans have to side with humanity or we are all in peril. I don't disagree with you. And if you've been a listener to any of my previous shows or the one I'm on now, Point Taken, pretty clear in my dislike of the actions and the words of this current inhabitant of the White House. But I also acknowledge that he's the president of the United States. Something I think some of us would like to forget sometimes, but that's not how it works. We have elected officials. Generally, they represent one or two parties, one of the two major parties, with some exceptions. There are some independents out there. That's our choice. And when one person wins, one party wins representing that elected official, they have to administer their entire district, their entire state, their entire country. Texter asked about prices. It seems like prices, I just quoted you, lowest in 5 years, the drop. Consumer prices. Pretty good. You can ignore it if you want to, but all of us who pay the grocery bill when we go to the store or buy things for our house, we look pretty closely at those budgets and how we spend our money. Trump can win this argument if he keeps prices down and the markets go up. At least on this side of the equation. There's other things that we're going to talk about in the weeks ahead and the months ahead that all differ starkly from what the President of the United States has to say. But on this one, right now, this might be a good week for Donald Trump. We'll ask the guys about that on tomorrow's show. Point taken, 620 WTMJ. How about that? Half hour's done already. Got the local news coming up with Jessica Tai. You can hear her middays. Most days with Greg Matzik, although Mike Spaulding's filling in today. So, big fan of Mike Spaulding, by the way. I miss his voice, his regular voice. I know he'd probably argue that he's just comfortable doing what he's doing, but I appreciate when he's on. So if you're a Mike Spaulding fan, boy or girl, you have 3 hours of them coming up in a little bit. All right, so we're going to be talking about tariffs, imports, exports, customs clearance, all the things related to that industry. What's happening in our ports? What's the real story? We're going to talk to an expert on the import, exports, and what's happening in our ports from Krenz and Hannah International. Leo Krenz will join us just after the bottom of the hour news. And then we have an entire hour with Jeremy Janine in the 11 o'clock hour talking about a lot of local stories, politics and otherwise, some transportation stuff. As he always brings it at the high level that he does, he's a great local reporter at urbanmilwaukee.com. And always looking forward to his visits. He'll join us in studio in a little bit. I got a Starbucks update at some point today. I'll tell you about my Hawaii trip. We're almost halfway sold out already. Are you kidding me? Well done, you. If I had my list in front of me, I'd shout out the people who just signed up. Six people signed up in the last 2 days. Thank you. Appreciate that. And we're still a year and a half away. I was going to say a month and a half. Ooh, year and a half away. I'm looking forward to all of that and all of you and meeting all of you in the great state of Hawaii. My 50th state. Yes, Jazz?
How upset would Rose Gray be with you if it was a month and a half away and you're trying to still get listeners to go with you?
I don't know if upset would be the word. It might be worse than that. But no, we're good. We always sell out our trips. I think I've sold out every trip I've had with Fox World Travel. So it's always been fun to work with them. And this is a great trip to go on. And I'm going to spend a segment talking about it because it's such a unique thing. One, to travel with listeners. I've gotten to know a bunch. There are couples that Kathy and I, we go out to dinner with them all the time. We also do the sort of either reunion meeting or a pre-trip meeting where we gather all the people and we sort of have drinks and some appetizers. We love that stuff. So, a lot of us who do what I do have spent a lot of time talking about tariffs, the impact of tariffs, what's going on in our country's economy and the world economy. So I know Chris and I both love doing this. We love talking to subject matter experts, and we have one today who lives in that reality. He's from Krenz and Hannah International. He is import manager, customs broker, Leo Krenz, who joins us on the hotline. Good morning, Leo.
Hey, good morning, Steve. How are you?
I am good. I am great on this day. So a couple of sort of general questions. I'd like to know from your experience, your day-to-day life, doing what you do, your company's experience as a result of sort of what I would describe as tariff uncertainty.
Sure. And to give you a little background, Steve, we're dealing with importers and exporters every
yes.
day. We're a licensed customs broker and freight forwarder dealing on both the freight side and helping import customers clear their shipments through U.S. Customs. So this is exactly what we're doing. And we're right in the middle of all of the hecticness. Right now, there's so much uncertainty in the industry. A lot of our customers just don't know how to deal with it. I mean, every day the regulations are changing. Every day there's clarity coming out from the powers that be, so the White House and U.S. Customs, which is causing more confusion. It's extremely challenging for our importers to plan. And then on top of that, now as things are changing, the freight market has been completely out of whack. So it's been nothing short of crazy the last few months here, Steve.
So what I'm hearing from some other people that I've talked to or at least read some of the things they're talking about is the impact on ports, the actual containers. I know you guys actually do a lot with the individual containers for businesses that actually price that out for people. What's happening in ports right now, real time, and like the shipping traffic numbers? What's coming back from China? What's going out of the United States? What are those numbers saying to you?
Sure. So we're seeing something that we've seen in the past, but only once in recent histories. We're seeing a very, very significant drop off in import freight from China primarily, but around the world. I mean, these tariffs they're affecting all countries. The baseline tariff of 10% on all products specifically, but the Chinese tariff over the last couple months, everyone's aware that the presidential administration has added some significant tariffs that over the weekend a trade deal has been struck that have pushed those off. I'll call them paused. But what that's done is it's just cratered the ocean freight market, and it's caused steamship lines to have to cancel vessels. There's a significant drop-off in import freight coming into our ports. So we're seeing this very, very, very big slowdown right now. Now, as the tariffs have been removed, or I'll call them paused again, now we're seeing a very, very, very sharp rise and increase. We saw something similar to this during COVID when At the initial stages of COVID, there was that shutdown phase where importers and businesses alike kind of had to take a pause and say, we're not going to import right now. We don't know where this thing's going. And that's what they've done these last few months. And what the cause of that was last time was a bullwhip effect that all of this freight came into the ports at the same times. We saw congestion, rail car shortages, container shortages in China. And if I had a crystal ball, I would expect the same thing is going to happen here because we're seeing these rampant volume increases, and importers are saying, especially with the pause, because it's not the tariffs haven't been canceled, they've just been paused. They're saying we need to ship right now because we don't know what the future is going to hold.
Import manager, customs broker Leo Krenz joining us from Krenz and Hanner International on WTMJ. I want to take a break here because there's a bunch of other questions I want to ask you. I want to give our audience a chance to refresh. We will continue the conversation with Leo Krenz. You're listening, of course, to Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. Continuing our conversation with Leo Krenz from Krenz and Hanner International, import manager, customs broker. I'm always fascinated by the relationship between small business, and I would classify you as a small business, but you do big things for businesses, small and large, manufacturers, small companies. What are those folks telling you, even at the local level? I know you do a lot of work here in Southeastern Wisconsin and Edwin, Wisconsin, Midwest. What are those managers, CEOs, company owners telling you?
Sure, Steve. And you're right. We do business with companies small and large all over the world, primarily Midwest-based, but all over the world. And what we're seeing is, I mentioned before, the uncertainty in the industry, but what is certain is the heightened cost of importing, especially from China. So what we're seeing is a lot of prospective supply chain retooling, I'll call it. A lot of companies are trying to figure out the best way to source their materials. And it's been clear now, more now than it ever has been, that China's been targeted by the presidential administration to fight the trade deficit we have with them. So it's clear that everybody knows this and they're looking for alternatives. Some of our clients, some of our importing clients, are lucky and they have possibilities of finding vendors that are in other countries outside of China. Some aren't. That's where the products that they're importing are made. There's no other options. So one thing we're seeing too is we are seeing a lot of imports from other countries that are not China but have relationships with China. So if you really look and dig into the numbers, a lot of this stuff is still being made in China. It's just being moved to other countries, having tariff changes and country of origin changes with manufacturing processes and being shipped from there. So ultimately, a lot of these goods still come from China, but there's definitely been a lot of supply chain retooling going on right now.
You mentioned the pandemic. You mentioned the bullwhip effects. What's different about it this time, other than the fact that it's coming from one person, the President of the United States? Is there other differences in how this is playing out?
Yeah, that's a great question. One big difference is there was rampant demand after the pandemic. So there were all of the issues I mentioned, but the driver of it was the bullwhip and the fact that everything was shut down for a while. But we saw crazy demand for international shipping and importing. That's still to be seen here. We'll see if the demand will mirror that. My inclination would be not because of the heightened cost of the importing, but that would be the first thing that I would say.
I'm going to give you an opportunity as we close it out to if you could speak to the President of the United States. I don't want it to be a political conversation. As someone who does what you do for a living, who sees the numbers, talks to these small businesses, large businesses, manufacturers, what would you suggest to the President if he wants to do something about tariffs? What would be the right strategy and how that would impact all the folks you deal with on a daily basis? So you have the floor.
That's a great question. As you can imagine, this comes up a lot. It isn't a political issue, but it is a political issue, unfortunately.
Sure.
What I would say is slow down. Everything that we've seen from the implementation standpoint of these tariffs has been rushed. dare I say, haphazard from a U.S. Customs standpoint. They can't keep up with the pace of this. And it's just causing challenges within our industry, programming specifically through U.S. Customs system where all these entries are being submitted and duties being calculated. They're not able to accept all of these additional tariff numbers. There's coding errors where one day we'll submit an entry and it'll pass through flying colors, and the next day we'll submit the exact same entry with and it'll get rejected, and we're on the phone for hours trying to talk with our software service provider why Customs is rejecting it. It's been a complete headache from our side as Customs brokers, and everything seems unnecessarily rushed. You can understand some of the objectives, but the pace just has been challenging for everybody in the industry.
I love it. Real life, real time, someone who actually does it for a living, Leo Krenz, Krenz & Hanna International. Let's check back in a couple months and see where we're at, okay?
Definitely. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Leo Krenz, Krenz & Hanna International. Good stuff. Good content. I mean, geez. That's somebody who does... We fall in love with talkers in this country, and I understand the irony of that because I'm a talker. But that's why we bring subject matter experts on the show, because they actually give us real information real time. That's the difference. And you heard him say it. It doesn't have to be political. Kind of going back to my first half-hour conversation. Whether you love the president or not, he's president. Things he does will impact your life, whether you voted for him or not. Love the conversation. I'm just getting warmed up. All right, a Starbucks update, because I'm just irritated about this. And some of you probably, I think Vince and Eric were talking a little bit about this. We'll do that after this on 620 WTMJ. Coffee event. Oh, yeah. Now I go to Starbucks, maybe. Point taken on 620 WTMJ, if you didn't know. Maybe once every 2 weeks now. I used to be a regular customer, and I don't not like or dislike Starbucks, but I just, I don't want to pay. I think it was about $3.80 when I was buying just a regular cup of coffee at Starbucks. Most people don't do that. They buy the other stuff. Including you, my friend Jim, who spends a lot of money at Starbucks every morning. He's retired. He's got the money. He can afford it. But you know who I'm talking about. So I saw this headline, and look, I get workers' rights, right to organize, right to be in unions. Here's the headline, AP. More than 1,000 Starbucks baristas go on strike to protest new dress code. 1,000 Starbucks baristas at 75 U.S. stores have gone on strike since Sunday to protest a new company dress code. And what is that dress code, you ask? Well, Starbucks has limits now on what you can wear underneath your green aprons. Everybody knows the green aprons. Iconic look. What they're requiring under the green apron now is a solid black shirt and... below the shirt, khaki, black, or blue denim pants or bottoms. Under the previous dress code, the baristas could wear a broader range of dark colors and patterned shirts. Starbucks arguing that the new black shirt requirement or black top requirement would highlight their green aprons, make them stand out, make the logo pop, my words, as their customers try to, as they navigate through the world of coffee, there's a lot of great coffee companies now, a lot of competition. Not an enemy of Starbucks, so don't put me in that category. But at some points, again, not going after unions, not going after workers' rights, but at some point, wear the damn shirt! What is the problem here? Now, maybe Starbucks will give them a one or two shirt allowance, kick it in on their next paycheck, whatever it is. Wear the damn shirt. Why is this so difficult? Let me answer my own question. Because we love to argue about everything nowadays. We absolutely have to argue about everything. A different response from these Starbucks unions could have been, we love this. We think it's going to really pop our brand. Could we possibly talk about a clothing allowance that would sort of transition into the new world, new reality for our uniforms? Very sensible, opening the conversation. Instead, they've gone on strike. Not over their hourly wage, not over their health benefits, not over whatever perks they have in their contracts. Over the color of their damn shirts. And actually, I think the black and green, I'm looking at a picture of an assembled group of Starbucks workers. It does pop. You can see the logo. Is it the sameness of the uniform that bothers people? Is that what? Is it too robotic or too mundane if you all dress the same? Couldn't you have like one worker wearing the khaki pants, one wearing the jeans? You could do it on the bottom and not the top. The top is black. It's a black shirt.
I don't know if jeans go well with a black top. I feel like jeans and khakis and a black shirt works very well. That's how it was when the grocery store I worked at.
Yeah. I used to have uniforms in some of my early life jobs. I worked at a grocery store. We had uniforms. Back then, we had to wear a tie and a white shirt. How about that? Did we go on strike? And I was in a union, retail clerks. I believe it was 444 or something like that. We didn't go on strike, or we just wore the damn shirt. Come on, Starbucks employees. And Starbucks. Figure it out. I like your coffee. I'm not going to go there every day, but I do like your coffee. All right, we got a break. After the break, the one, the only, Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com. Lots of local stories. We're going to cover them in depth for the next hour. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all the great texts, by the way. You guys are on fire today. Appreciate each and every one of you. I'm responding in the breaks as much as I can. You're listening, of course, to 620 WTMJ. Point taken.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
And Kristen is off on assignment. She'll be back tomorrow with Bill and Joe on our Friday wrap-up of the weekend politics. But she comes here every Thursday, second hour. Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com is where you can find his great work. Now, Kristen and I talked a bit about this. It was yesterday, the day before. The deadly fire in Milwaukee. It's not the first time this has happened. And the question of sprinklers, and more importantly, should we require, and we know that the law, I think it's pre-79, something like that?
68, I think, is the magic here.
Those buildings do not have to be sprinklered. You can do it if you want to, but as we've talked about, and Chris and I talked about, there's some argument about the cost of that. But I guess the big question for me is, where is this issue going when it comes to Milwaukee leadership, certainly the community itself? What are they saying and talking about on this issue?
I predict future Point Taken episodes, we're going to be talking a lot about, when it comes to Milwaukee Common Council and City of Milwaukee government, the International Building Code, the Uniform Building Code. And what does that actually mean? Because you hit on that I think it's 68 is the magical year, which after that point, buildings above a certain size had to have sprinklers. Well, that didn't mean retroactively you had to change all that. And you're like, well, that's a basic safety thing. But the building code is always evolving. It's small little things like plumbing. When I tour new apartment buildings, the developers are always pointing out, like, oh, we had to do this little tweak under the sink. And you wouldn't want to immediately make it retroactive. And you and Kristen talked about this yesterday. We're like, we have this cost out there of $3 a square foot. And that seems low when I talk to other people. And there are buildings where it's just going to be logistically very, very hard to get in sprinklers. But I'm talking to Alderman Robert Bauman, who represents the area where the fire occurred, actually even lives near where the fire occurred on 27th and Highland. There's an interest in the Common Council in exploring what can we do to make safety improvements.
And there's no disagreement, because I just talked to Chief Lipsky about this a couple days ago, that sprinklers work. They save lives. They not just for the residents that are impacted, but for firefighters. And they lower the risk of injury, and they lower the risk of the fire getting out of control. That's why every hotel you see has sprinklers in them, and that's why you see all the new stuff having sprinklers. And I get it, and there is disagreement on cost. But ultimately, when we talk about public safety, in whatever way you want to look at that question, whether it's reckless driving or this issue, it comes down to cost, and then, of course, who's paying for it? Now, I would argue, and I'm not generally loved by conservatives for saying this, when you have a state budget surplus, that's the moment when you can actually start doing stuff like this. Now, as Kristen pointed out correctly to me yesterday, there are a lot of legislators who are also in the landlord business.
And I don't know if that's exactly what's in play. That's certainly a factor, especially when it comes to sprinkler requirements on small buildings.
Right.
And Steve, I'm sure you don't have sprinklers in your house. I don't have sprinklers in my house. Most people live in a home in Milwaukee that does not have sprinklers, and under any, regardless of the date, is not required to have sprinklers.
Right.
But when we look at these big buildings, Chief Lipsky has made it clear, like, yes, this is a safety thing for the residents and for the people trying to put out the fire. It is a huge question on who pays, and ultimately it has to be the people paying the rent.
Do you think ultimately, to use your word, that this is going to come some sort of a, okay, this is what we're going to do point in the near future? Like, this is what we're going to do in Milwaukee going forward. Could that happen here?
My guess is where this heads in Milwaukee, and this might be different across the state. There are certain triggers. You get a permit for X. Well, then you must comply with all these old provisions. And that's how some of these pre-1968 buildings end up with sprinklers in them, is they do some other alteration. Hotels are a great example. They're always getting permits to update everything. So if they don't comply, they're eventually going to have to comply because they're going to get a permit. This building on 27th and Highland hadn't had a permit of, I think it's level 3 is the technical term, for years and years. So it never had to comply. I will think we'll see the city tighten the screws down to make it as much as they legally can require sprinklers and other safety improvements.
And chiefs and firefighters will also tell us that it's not just about sprinklers. There's a lot of other things involved in these fires and maintenance, you know, smoke detectors, all these things. There's a lot we can do to make ourselves safer in our own homes or in the case of some of these larger units, multifamily units that can make everybody more safe. He is Jeremy Janine, Urban Milwaukee. How can folks find your great work?
UrbanMilwaukee.com.
All right. Lots to get to, including I'm going to ask Jeremy this incredible question. What's a boom car? Coming up on 620 WTMJ. Going to be hot in the city today. Don't forget, as I said at the beginning of the opening of the show, point taken today, pay attention to those weather forecasts. You don't have to like what they're going to say, but just be careful out there as we see severe storms approaching our area. We'll keep you updated all day right here on 620 WTMJ. Jeremy Janine joining us as he does every Thursday here on Point Taken. All right, Jeremy. Third Ward, historic Third Ward, as they like to call themselves. I'm not saying they're a bunch of complainers. They like to bring up things that bother them, though. Maybe I'll put it that way. Is that a nicer way of saying that? Maybe.
We can look at Hanson's Landing and the building that it's attached to on the river.
Right.
That is, I believe, the highest value residential building in the state of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of attorneys live there, and there are lots of opinions that emanate from that building. And they have a legitimate gripe with what's happening near their building.
So this reporting that you're going to talk about today has to do with noise.
Noise. So if you're on East Erie Street, Erie and Water Street, and you follow that the entire way to the lake, if you're a big music fan, it's the space behind the amphitheater, the American Family Insurance Amphitheater. Or if you're a naturalist or a runner or a biker, it's where the south end of Lakeshore State Park. There's kind of a no man's land back there.
Yeah.
And legally, it ends up being a no man's land, too, because East Erie Street ends, so it ceases to be a city street. And there's people gathering here, so legally who controls it is a key question. It ceases to be a city street. It is technically part of the Port of Milwaukee, which is then leased to Milwaukee World Festival, which is then, there's an easement related to Lakeshore State Park with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And I've been told there are 4 wardens for all of southeastern Wisconsin for the DNR. And we don't want the DNR handing out parking tickets in downtown Milwaukee. That seems like a bad use of resources. But you now have this area, kind of overlooked area, easy to get to, hard to exactly see what's happening there. But late at night, there's lots of noise that emanates there. Underneath the Hone Bridge is another great geographic reference.
All right, what's this boom car thing you're talking about?
It is a shorthand way to describe a car that is deliberately, in Milwaukee we can go to motorcycles too, deliberately souped up to make an excessive amount of noise.
Which is a perfect segue to my next comment. Look, I understand maybe on the motorcycle thing, but anybody who deliberately makes their car, vehicle, truck noisier for whatever reason you've decided is an idiot. I don't know how I can say it in any other nicer way than that or worse way. It's just dumb. There's no reason to do that. And I always am fascinated by the people that do this. Like, you're spending your own hard-earned money. You're making your car an outlier, and everyone has to, so they look at you, and often these cars aren't worthy or vehicles aren't worthy of the attention. I don't get it. Maybe motorcycles make sense. I know that's an awareness that we know that you're there. Totally get that. Vehicles, we already know you're there. You're driving around in the streets. We're on the streets, too. We can see you. Beyond that, I know that they're looking at some of the potential to sort of remodel or redo that area. How likely is that?
So the DNR is between a $6 and $10 million plan, which is there's no lights down there. Let's add lights. Let's rebuild all the pavement. That's not going to happen, in part because it requires state authority. Not going to happen anytime soon because it requires state authority. DNR also is only supposed to spend money on land that it owns, which, as I went through, they do not own this land. They just kind of control it. So they have a $15,000 plan, which is to put up a gate, and that's going to happen this fall.
Is that a secure gate? Is that what they're talking about? Or just you can't drive past that?
You can't drive past it. It's supposedly going to be remote controlled, which I'll be curious to see what the next issue is of the gates not open.
There's literally some remote state worker controlling the gates on and off.
Well, it becomes complicated because it's also the gate to get to the back of the amphitheater for Summerfest. Yeah. It is the gate for emergency vehicles to get to Lakeshore State Park. And there's a lot of people out there on certain days. So it's an important point to have a controlled access to. But then the issue is dirt bikes are a big factor here. People making all kinds of noise, running around in packs on dirt bikes, often teenagers. Well, the bike trail, the Riverwalk area, has to stay open. That's not part of the gate. And part of that's so people have access to fish right up by the lighthouse there. Well, what are we going to see happen with the dirt bikes? Are they just going to go around it, or are they going to get the message and simply go somewhere else?
So you talk to residents. I know one of them is cited in your piece. Do they feel like they're being listened to? Or no?
They themselves are making lots of noise, and the squeaky wheel is getting the grease here.
Right.
So I think they feel like there's things happening. They want it to happen faster. They're acknowledging that while this is legally complicated, we want things happening.
He is Jeremy Janine. Take an early break here. Lots more to talk about, including an election-related story that I think is fascinating and something that I think I mentioned that once after this happened on election night. We'll get to that story with Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com. After this on 620 WTMJ. Oh, thanks for tuning in on this Thursday edition right here on 620 WTMJ. Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com, his great writing on a lot of local stories that, frankly, they cover better than anybody else. All right, so you and I talked, I think, election night about this. Not having enough ballots. Sort of a big deal when you're going to vote on election night or whenever and they don't have enough ballots. They're going to expand the number, apparently.
In Milwaukee, there's about 180 polling places. That stays consistent regardless of the scale of the election. On election night, April 1st, it was thought that seven of them had, and this will get to an issue of why it was, the numbers are moving. It was thought seven of them had actually ran out of ballots. And it turns out it was actually nine of them. And there was another group, 69 of the 180 experienced some level of shortage where they were raising concern. That caused what Election Director Paulina Gutierrez detailed last week to the Judiciary and Legislation Committee, this rolling series of issues that just broke down every process that the Election Commission had.
It's a weird story because you want people to go vote. You're excited that more people showed up, but at the end of the day, we got to have ballots for these people. And I also, having run a city, I know there's costs associated with that. Have they talked about that piece of this and what that might do to budgets that are often very tight?
We have not gotten, we the public, have not gotten a specific number yet of what it costs. So the plan is now, for every April spring election, there's going to be a Supreme Court election on every election through like 2030 or 2031. They're going to, for every registered voter, which is something like 120,000 minimum in Milwaukee, they're going to print a ballot for that person. They don't expect that many people to show up every time, but this is the CYA be prepared amount of ballots. Because what happened is in January, Paulina Gutierrez, the head of Milwaukee's elections, ordered a turnout, I think it was 45%. Then all the Elon Musk spending started happening and all the other outside spending. So she increased it by like 10% more, and it still wasn't enough. And it was very disparate impact. The issue was primarily on the northwest side of the city, but the ballots are stored in the southeast side of the city. So even driving the ballots to the polling places was becoming a nightmare.
Is there a general consensus on how Gutierrez did in the administering of this election?
There seems to be in the council a belief that she is process-oriented and is building processes that are, unlike what has happened in the past, well-documented, which isn't a knock on anyone in the past, just that she is really building a system that could outlive her or anyone else. Someone comes in, picks up the Bible on how to run elections, and it's all written out.
Got a little time before the bottom of the hour news, which for you kids is 11:30. Harley surviving the ouster by its second biggest shareholder to try to get the CEO out. What do you make of that story?
We have not heard the end of this. Jochen Zietz, Harley announced he's been CEO since February 2020. He's been on the board since 2007. He had this Hardwire initiative, and H Partners, a New York hedge fund, is basically concluded very publicly that we don't think it's working. We don't think your work from home policy is working. We don't think your response to the DEI challenge that Robbie Starbuck mounted against company, not no criticism of the DEI policies, but of the response to it, That was bad. And the biggest thing is you're underperforming the S&P 500 for a long time now. They tried to get Zeitz and two other board members tossed. That didn't work. They narrowly failed by 2 percentage points yesterday. But they claim that Harley has been going around privately and confirming that Zeitz is out and these two other board members are out. So their thing was, we lost the battle, but we won the war.
It's an interesting story because, one, it's a iconic brand in our city, in our state for that matter. But it's something that we are known for. And the fact that it's having some issues, sort of, I don't know if transitioning is the right word, but just figuring out where this market, this industry, this sector goes next, it's not easy. I mean, I have a lot of friends who own Harleys. They're not inexpensive. They've tried to craft a different version of that to make that more affordable, but with mixed results. So it's a challenging industry at a challenging time for companies.
Going back to when I was in college during the Great Recession, and you said you have a lot of friends that own Harleys. The challenge is I don't have a lot of friends that own Harleys. And almost 20 years ago when I was in college, I had a professor, a business school professor, that was like, in 10 plus years, this is going to be a great case study of how this brand either reinvents itself or is slowly dying off when it faces that its demographics are going against it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story that we're all going to pay attention to because of who it is. Real quick update on a Tierman Spencer case. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but there's not much happening other than it's not going to be plea bargained.
It's not. His attorney was asked after the hearing last week, what are the chances Tierman accepts a settlement? Zero, he said, was emphatic. That a trial is now scheduled for late October, and I think we're going to see that trial happen.
He is Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com. You can find their great work, and you can subscribe to their great reporting. It is one of the best sources for local and Milwaukee area news. After the break for news, which with Julia Fellow and the latest from ABC, we're going to have a couple interesting stories. An open house coming up on 794. This thing is starting to move through the process, and those open houses are a big way to sort of see where that's going. And whatever else is on Jeremy's mind as we sort of kick it around on the show. Don't forget, if you miss any or all of our broadcasts, Point Taken, any of the shows for that matter on 620 WTMJ, all available on our podcast pages. Easy to find, WTMJ.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget, since I do a lot of them, Schmidtiology, sort of everything other than politics. I've had some great conversations about all things other than things I talk about on this show. We have You Need to Listen, which I think is going to be published today, our newest one. I'll let you see what that's going to be. Hot town, summer in the city. Back of my neck, getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Happy Thursday, everybody. Point Taken is the program. Kristen is off today. She'll be back tomorrow along with Bill McCaution and Joe Zepecki. Jeremy Janine from UrbanMilwaukee.com in studio. A little election cleanup before we move on to 794.
There was a key thing that we didn't discuss. 9 places ran out of ballots. The question is then, what happened to those people? The short answer is, we don't know. There is no one that definitively told the election commission, according to Paulina Gutierrez, that they could not vote. But what we don't know, we being the proverbial we, the people, is if someone looked at that and had to wait an hour or two for the ballots to arrive, did they just leave? Did they call it off? And thankfully, it seems Milwaukee's votes were not the deciding factor at any point in any of the elections that were on the ballot. But just looking at what the Election Commission does going forward, one of the challenges is the warehouse where all the ballots are stored, and the ballots are printed not by the city of Milwaukee in most cases, but a third party, is in the southeast corner of the city at the edge of Bayview. The places that were running out of ballots are, if you just want an indicator, like up towards Northridge Mall. And then, okay, you just call someone to drive them there. Well, the city didn't know, because it's never had this level of stress before, where those couriers it calls and where its employees are. So it couldn't call Joe because it knows Joe is on his way back to Bayview and say, hey, I got a delivery for you to go up north. So that really broke down, and it was an hour or two wait minimum to get the ballots up to those places.
Yeah, and that's concerning. I mean, we don't want anyone showing up day of the election and being told, yeah, it's going to be a while, and then they leave, because that's not the ability to exercise your right to vote in this country, which is a guaranteed right under the Constitution. So I think that is something that we have to pay attention to. And just, it gives me just a chance to quickly talk about the fact that we have to, in the state of Wisconsin, this is for the legislature, we have to approve the counting of these ballots during the day of Election Day or pre-polls closing, because it just, everyone, other states have had great results doing this, Florida being the most glaring example. They were the horrific example in 2000, but they've gotten their act together, and often the first state to report on the East Coast. It's an example of what actually taking the politics out of it and just doing the right thing when it comes to the administration or election, how it makes so much sense. All right. Pivot to 794.
All right.
Or as they say in the transportation business, change lanes.
Change lanes. They're right outside the door to 794. We are talking about the stretch of 794 that runs between the Marquette Interchange to the Hone Bridge. We're not necessarily talking about the Marquette Interchange. We're not talking about removing, replacing, rebuilding the Hone Bridge, but that east-west stretch through downtown. It's from the 1970s. No matter what, it needs to be rebuilt. It's old, aging concrete, particularly the stretch east of the river that wasn't rebuilt as part of the Marquette Interchange project. So we're now years into this discussion of what are we going to do with it? Well, finally, we're going to get on May 29th, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation is going to give options. It appears they're going to give us four options of what they want to do.
So this is one of those things that comes up when we talk about freeway stuff. There's always those who do not like freeways. There's always those who want them to look and act and work differently. And I think these public forums, these, you know, sort of open meetings are a good chance for people to do that. And I know there's always legal challenges. Some of the stuff that we're seeing now with the I-94 East-West is, you know, going to be consumed by a lot of that over the next few years. Massive amounts of money committed to this project. But this is a question that came in for you when the texter found out you were on the show. If this gets removed, and I think they mean down to the street level, right?
Yep.
That traffic's got to go somewhere. I know it's not a huge volume, relatively speaking, for a downtown, especially compared to other downtowns. But it does have to go somewhere, and does it add traffic to some already congested other areas, including, you know, your community, Bayview area? I think it's a fair question to ask.
Absolutely, and that, I think, is why it's one of the reasons we're seeing this meeting was delayed. Just to kind of set the stage, the four options we're likely to see from the state are rebuild it exactly as is. Then we're going to see two options that are, and we know this because they revealed them in a stakeholder meeting earlier that our Milwaukee reported on. We're going to see two options that would slim down the freeway's footprint, and part of how they would slim it down is remove exits downtown. And the reason there's two options for that is there's left-hand exits or there's right-hand exits in their variants. And then the last option is a boulevard option. And the texter is asking about the boulevard option. They're asking the right question, where does that traffic go? And that's been a question the city of Milwaukee has admitted it's asking of state officials. For perspective, there's about 70,000 cars a day that use this stretch of 794. But only 26,000 go end to end. So we can assume that those other 50 or so thousand are people that are going downtown or that they're originating the trip downtown. They're leaving downtown to go somewhere else. So using the perspective of my wife, who is one of these people that drives through it, she goes from Bayview up to the northwest side of Milwaukee. How does her trip change? Depending on what speeds we see on this proposed boulevard, how long do they think it'll take? She might just continue to go through downtown, but instead of flying through on a freeway, she'll be on grade. Or she could end up on Oklahoma Avenue and zooming over to Holt, or she could end up going up to Beecher and Lincoln. So there will be traffic impacts. That's particularly a question that the port has raised. The port has this wider road that serves it from Beecher, but there's not a lot of traffic on it. So that's one of the things I'll be very curious to see what the state has with its models at the meeting. One of the other things I want to look at is just what they think the footprint would be downtown for the actual freeway if it was a boulevard.
Sort of related, but not really. The Couture area, that area on the street level east of the Couture facing the lake, when is that going to be redone? Is that part of this too?
So there's two projects there. Immediately at Michigan Street, immediately next to the Couture, that'll happen sometime, I think, this summer even or next summer. That's a city project. Then to the south, that on-ramp area that everyone hates, that gets redone as part of this project.
Okay.
For perspective, actually, because that area gives a good context. 26,000 cars. No one has any idea what that means when you say that. Lincoln Memorial Drive, that stretch right there, handles 31,000 cars a day. So that's, if you want an idea of what that traffic volume is, look at Lincoln Memorial Drive.
Well, I changed my path to work a year or so ago, because I still took 94 up until, I don't know, sometime last year. And I take the Hone Bridge, and I go north, and I take the left on Michigan and come right to the parking garage here. It works great, but it's an interesting sort of way coming back out of that. So I actually don't take that same route back. I make the out of the parking structure, I'll go back and take that little piece of the 794 elevated to Tejon. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I forgot what street that is. Is that Second? No, it's east of that. It's east of the river.
You're talking where it loops around?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or in the west of the river.
Well, either way, So there's one going east, one going west that loops around to go west. I take those occasionally.
So one of the things that was interesting about when the Park East Freeway came down is travel times actually got shorter because there were more options. You eliminated what are essentially this elevated one-way street to use the street grid to diffuse people. I think one of the things that's happening with your travel is Clybourne is this one-way street going west. The vision we're likely to see from the state is a two-way street, and what does that actually mean? What do they model?
Yeah, so what's the date? Someone asked, what's the date of the open house?
May 29th at the Milwaukee Marriott downtown, 625 North Milwaukee Street, from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Open house. Come whenever you are. The exhibits after the meeting will be online on the WSDOT website.
All right, after the break, we got a new corporate headquarters come to Milwaukee, and it didn't require something that we typically see. We'll ask Jeremy about that and more. On 620 WTMJ. Point taken. Talking with Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com this hour on sort of local issues, everything from 794 to, I'm not going to jump ahead yet. There's a lot of questions on the same theme on the text line, citing a limited WTMJ talk and text line. They go like this. What happens when the bridge goes go up for the, you know, the traffic on the river in the summer? How do you get over the river when boats are coming through? All that stuff. Those are sort of the considerations that are going to have to be figured out, right? Because travel times matter and, you know, moving people around, mobility is still the reason for roadways.
We'll see at the meeting. I hope to see hard data on actually how many times those bridges go up. I'm sure almost everyone in Milwaukee has at some point been stuck waiting for the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge or another bridge downtown to go up. The question there, well, the issue is when you switch from a freeway to a boulevard, it's going to come lower. The freeway is high enough right now that it doesn't have to open and close. The boulevard would be. Then how often does it have to open and close under a normal scenario? The real question gets back to like the Northwest Territory because the waterways actually are a priority.
I was going to ask you that.
So that there are a couple with, I'm going to go way out on a legal limb here. It's something with the Coast Guard, I believe, of who's got what window is a priority. There's like a rush hour window. I think there's one in the morning, but there's a longer one in the evening. It's between like 4:30 and 5:30, the bridges aren't supposed to be open. Could you extend that? What is the legality of doing that? I know that ends up in the Federal Register when there's decisions. It gets wonky, and I hope we'll see an explanation here because that is a serious issue that needs to, okay, can we mitigate it? Or no, that's a deal breaker.
I know this. There will be lawyers.
There will be lawyers, yes.
All right. Apparently, we're getting a new headquarters, and it didn't require a subsidy.
Yes.
Which is sort of a rarity nowadays.
It didn't require a city subsidy. The state gave a token subsidy to it of $500,000. But Enerpac Tool Group Court is now connected to the 620 WTMJ studios because it's a Westtown tenant in what is now the Enerpac Center. It was the ASQ Center. Enerpac, you probably know them as Exuent, and they were a kind of an industrial holding company. Starting in about 2020, 2019, they bet on their Enerpac division. Simple explanation of what they do is they make equipment that's hydraulic that lifts stuff, and that means they lift train cars or they lift the roof of American Family Field when it needs to be repaired.
You know, that's a big one.
Yeah, so this is sometimes very small handheld equipment, or it is absolutely massive equipment.
Any idea on number of employees?
There's about 130 employees that now work in what is the Enerpac Center. They lease the entire fourth floor, what used to be the Gimbel's building, nice terracotta clad building. They have 2,100 employees spread across the globe. There's about 500 in Wisconsin. You're like, what are those other 400 in Wisconsin? They're almost all in manufacturing jobs. They have two plants in Wisconsin.
Jeremy and Janine, one more segment. We'll find out what is on his mind to cover, what meeting he's looking forward to standing in and reporting on. We'll get all that information from Jeremy and Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com. After this, Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. A few more minutes left of the Thursday edition of Point Taken. Kristen will be back tomorrow for those asking. And I'm sure she'll have a lot on her mind. She's doing some great stuff in Madison the last couple days. Jeremy Janine, what are you going to be thinking about covering this week?
I was looking at my calendar. I've got a pretty full list coming up. We have the Redevelopment Authority this afternoon, which might put people to sleep, but that is where we just talked about the lack of subsidies, but subsidies actually originate in the city of Milwaukee. There's two affordable housing developments being advanced, both in the Harambe area, near kind of MLK and North, if you're looking for geographic reference. One would build almost 60 single-family homes. There might be some duplexes mixed in with that, with a target of home ownership. Another would renovate a what is becoming dilapidated apartment building and create new quality housing out of this old building. The city is making essentially minor financial commitments to both that will be repaid by property tax revenue. Staying on housing, tomorrow morning there is a Milwaukee, I labeled it the Milwaukee Community Land Trust, but it's the Community Development Alliance bus tour of all the different housing projects happening in Milwaukee in terms of different housing initiatives that we touch on. So look for coverage on that in Urban Milwaukee. And then Friday evening is the Mayor's Design Awards. Not great for radio, but a lot of visuals of what the best looking buildings in Milwaukee are. No surprise, things like the Couture are included.
Yeah, there's some great architecture in the city. And I've talked to people that have actually taken trips to Milwaukee for the first time and say, oh my goodness. And it's not just the Calatrava. It's just like some of the cool architecture, the building styles that we have. It's all over the board from really old to really new, like the Couture.
What I like about the Mayor's Design Awards is they award not just the big, shiny, sexy project, but they look at like small little business rehabs. Like, did you take an auto body shop and make it into a restaurant? And it looks really nice. We're going to award that too.
All right. Give me your Giannis take. Could you live with a Bucks reality that did not include Giannis Antetokounmpo?
As an NBA junkie, I understand the ramifications of needing to trade him. The cupboard is quite bare for the Bucks right now. They are in dire straits.
I would say this. I'll answer my own question. I understand they have challenges, and certainly losing Dame for however long that's going to be is not helpful to this equation because he sucks up a lot of that capital you need to get and acquire players. But I enjoy watching Giannis play. And if you surround him with some young players, this could be a pretty fun, competitive team that people want to watch. I lived through some bad Bucks years, and I was here since the beginning. And I actually used to hand out things in my high school years at the old arena to people going to the Bucks games, and then that was Lou Alcindor days. I've seen it all. And I've seen the rough years when we didn't have great teams. It's not fun to go through.
I had season tickets for a couple of years before Giannis and could not give away my tickets on many nights. Yeah. I think just the depressing thing about where the Bucks find themselves is they just don't have draft picks going forward to get those young players.
So put us in the yes, keep Giannis category.
Yeah, it make basketball more fun in Milwaukee.
There you go. Jeremy Janine, we'll do it again next Thursday. Thanks as always for being here.
Thanks for having me.